This episode of the Gabfest contains explicit language.
Hello and welcome to the Slate Political Gabfest for July 25th, 2019, the not exculpated edition. I am David Plotz of Atlas Obscuro, Washington, D.C. So exciting. Why is it exciting? In our sweatbox of a studio.
It's fine right now.
Yeah,
it's not
well, right
even
now,
hot.
He's just anticipatory.
It's because we just started. Yeah. We have all three of us, and just the combined intellectual heat that we're going to generate on the show is going to, we're going to cut weight for our wrestling matches later. We're going to be down 10 pounds each. So I have Emily Bazelon of the New York Times Magazine and Yale. Hello, Emily.
Hello, hello.
Why are you in Washington?
I came to give a book talk, and I stayed to tape the show with you two lovely people.
And John Dickerson of CBS 60 Minutes. John, why are you in Washington?
I'm in Washington to do interviews for my book and write some of it at my old kitchen table.
I cannot tell you how excited John is to do his interviews. If the quality of a book was based on the excitement of the author's reporting, this book is going to be the best book ever written.
That is a good sign, though. It means you're interested in your subject,
well,
which
that,
is not a given at this point in a book process.
That's totally true. And David, tell them what the interview I was telling you that I'm doing later today.
John's interviewing somebody who's an expert in regulations. But John was so excited. He started at some riff. I was not paying any attention. But he was going on and on, and I tuned out, and I was checking my email, and then I came back to it a few minutes later, and he was still talking about that
person. I am eager to hear that riff later.
But it's really true. I've often said, no, I think it's you have to be able to live with a book in your head for as long as you're going to be writing it, or else you'll go crazy, which is why there are some books that I've chosen not to write. And this one is, I could do this book for the next 10 years if I had the time.
I'm sure your publisher's really
happy
to hear that.
Yeah, I'm sure that, exactly. anyway, it'll all be fine. Everybody's fine. It's all good.
So, on a show, we're going to do a show. On this week's show, Robert Mueller testifies to the House. Was it a bombshell or just a bomb? Then, did Democrats make a terrible mistake by pressuring Al Franken to resign? We'll talk about Jane Mayer's big New Yorker story about Franken's defenestration. Then there's a bipartisan deal in the works to raise the debt ceiling, avoid a government shutdown, and increase government spending. What is not to like? I'll tell you what's not to like. Plus, we'll have cocktail chatter. And a reminder, GabFest listeners in the Midwest, Upper Midwest, Canada.
Or visitors to said region.
On Wednesday, September 18th, we're going to be live at the Fitzgerald Theater in St. Paul, Minnesota. First Twin Cities Live Gabfest. We will have also a pre-show cocktail hour. There are still tickets available. Go to slate.com/live. They are going fast, though, so get your tickets now. slate.com/live. We want to see you on September 18th in St. Paul. Robert Mueller testified laconically before two House committees on Wednesday. This hearing had been much anticipated really almost for years, as Democrats were excited to create the highest possible profile hearing about his report into Russian interference in the election and into the president's potential obstruction of justice and collusion. And it seemed clear that the primary purpose of this hearing was less about fact dissemination or fact sharing than it was about the optics of it, to attract an audience and create a dramatic moment damning the president. So, Emily, in that sense, it was basically an utter failure for the Democrats. Yes?
Was it an utter failure or just like a kind of soft dud? I guess that's the debate this morning, right? The utter failure theory is that there was nothing new that emerged from this and no big moment of drama. I didn't watch the whole hearing. I just watched various highlight compilations. And when you're listening, you know, there are a few moments, but Mueller's tone is not particularly strong or dramatic. We can talk about whether he seemed kind of off his game to a degree that was unsettling for some people who've watched him for a long time. And it was mostly repeating allegations that have been made many times against Donald Trump. So if that was the measure, I don't think the Democrats succeeded. I'm not sure that's a fair measure, though.
Yeah, it feels like this this hearing is falling into a question we've pawed over here for years, it feels like now, which is the standard of something, whether there was something revelatory in specific or revelatory outside of a pattern we've come to expect, or is it important to talk about things at length in certain different forums because you should keep concentration on things that should concern us, like whether the president and his team were at least open to Russian interference in the election, that the Russians are interfering right now, that lots and lots of members of the president's team lied, sometimes when they didn't seem to have to, whether the president can openly tell his staff not to participate and engage with Congress, all of which is not new and isn't revelatory and came through in, as far as the show goes, in not a very exciting way. But I think that just back to what Emily said is none of that should really matter because the underlying facts of the case are still extraordinary. But then the question is a congressional hearing, anybody who schedules a congressional hearing for the purposes of putting on a show and doesn't get a show, you know, they shouldn't be surprised. And by the way, the show you're going to get is going to be a circus, almost, it's almost certainty.
Well, pretty boring circus.
Where were the lions and the elephants?
There were elephants. That's what the Republicans are there for.
Plenty of asses.
But the question, I mean, I get your very high-minded point there. You know, the purpose is, of course, that we should focus attention on it. But truly, the Democrats created this hearing because they wanted a show.
Yes.
They wanted a spectacle.
The purpose was optical.
They got some sound bites. They got very little.
So
on that point, which is, it also, to me, reflected a seriously bad judgment on their part, because Mueller is a dreary, tight-lipped, uninteresting, prosecutorial, you know, I can't remember the word, but it's one of those words that they always use to describe Roman politicians. You know, he's very dignified, imperturbable. They were not going to get anything out of that guy.
And he made it clear he didn't want to come. I was thinking of that word, too, and then I couldn't remember what
it meant.
I think
it's stentorian loud, though.
Stentorian does mean what you said, David, which is loud and powerful.
I think of stentorian as being loud. I'm thinking of more red. It's one of those R words. Anyway, I'll think of it.
Okay.
Rectitude. Rectitude.
We usually talk about
figure
moral
rectitude.
Figure
of rectitude.
Right. Yeah, that's all true, and he didn't want to testify, and there's that. But if they hadn't called him, wouldn't that have been strange in its own?
No one would have noticed. Dog didn't bark.
I would have noticed.
If he wasn't called.
Yeah.
But he had a 448-page report. Can't we go with that?
I know, but that's part. So here, can we get a little bit into the substance of this? Because I'm now even more bewildered. Okay, yes, we have a 448-page report, which is, in its conclusions, not that clear and self-evident what's going on, right? It makes this very, in some ways, strange decision not to indict the president, sort of hedges on whether that decision is because of the Justice Department's own policies or because of the underlying facts. We don't really emerge with more clarity on that point from this hearing. I mean, Mueller does at first seem to suggest, when under Ted Lieu's questioning, that the Justice Department's decision from the Office of Legal Counsel meant that he couldn't indict, and then he withdrew from that. And that was like a kind of deflation of the day, right? So there's that problem. Then there's the problem that what seemed clear to me from the hearing that I should have understood before, but it seemed clear, was that Mueller's true cause for alarm is like the Russians tried to interfere with our election. Like,
mine too.
Huge threat to democracy. I wish he had said that in a more, you know, crystal clear ring of alarms style, but that's the message. So if that's his biggest threat, and then he can see, because it was public, all this evidence of President Trump essentially encouraging this kind of interference in the statements he made about WikiLeaks, why isn't he more exercised? And why has he left the country in this kind of odd place in which we have evidence in the report that the president obstructed justice, but Mueller has refused to draw any conclusion about that, even though our attorney general, Bill Barr, did draw such a conclusion. So it's not against Justice Department policy to make any kind of conclusion. That's just not the case anymore. That was a line of questions about Barr that the Democrats didn't pursue yesterday, which seemed strange. And yet we're also not off the hook. Like, we don't as a country feel like Trump was exonerated because Mueller made clear that he was not exonerated. So we have all this information that doesn't lead us to a clear either legal or political conclusion. And this is what prosecutors are not supposed to do, right? Is to just like create a whole lot of doubt about someone's guilt or innocence without settling the matter. And I can't understand. It's as if Mueller in some ways was trying to avoid the error that Jim Comey made when he started talking too much about the investigation of Hillary Clinton, but he's and yet seems to have done the same thing, which is a legitimate complaint I thought the Republicans had yesterday. And I can't fit all those pieces of the puzzle into a neat picture for myself in understanding what the special counsel thought his role was, like why he did what he did.
And which is why, from a purely political standpoint, if you are Democrats and your intention was to create an optical moment, which I think David is right about, first of all, that's crazy, having watched any hearing take place in Washington, because you know that it's going to turn into Republicans attacking the witness and a fuzzying up of things. And I think the president has been successful by saying there was that Mueller said there was no collusion and no obstruction, because then what he's had, a lot of people, very smart people, have said, here are the questions Mueller should be asked. Mueller should be asked, was there no collusion and no obstruction? So ask him that and get him to say that. So they did. Okay. So now the story is Mueller says there was no obstruction and no collusion. That's playing on the president's turf. So some people will hear that and say, oh, well, you know, he said, she said, instead of what should be at issue here, which is that the Russians interfered in the election and that the person who is constitutionally given the power to take care of America's national security didn't seem that interested in it.
And didn't care at all. Was, and like, in fact, happy had to offer us up, actually.
And had aides not telling him about Russian continued efforts because they didn't want to upset him, and then criticized the intelligence agencies repeatedly and recently for saying that the Russians were involved in the election. This is not a candidate who's trying to gain power and doing a bunch of things that you can excuse because it's a campaign, even though I would argue you shouldn't excuse these things in campaigns. But nevertheless, this is a person who is constitutionally mandated to protect the United States and who was, instead of doing that, attacking his intelligence agencies who said this is what the Russians were up to. Now, that is separate and apart from anything having to do with James Comey and how this all started and any of the stuff that people want to bring up.
It should have clarity on its own.
That should have its own clarity. Instead, because the president said, Mueller said there was no collusion, no obstruction, he shifted the territory into something that people now think is debatable, which, by the way, isn't debatable because if you read the report, it doesn't say those things. So I think that the this was a process that actually helps the president confuse what's in the report rather than focusing us on the substance of what's the report. And that was the decision of the Democrats to hold this hearing.
But
and
I don't think it's just the Democrats' fault. I mean, yes, sure, you can blame them. But it's also Mueller. This is what I'm like fixated on. Here is this figure, yes, of moral rectitude and institutionalism and patriotism. And he has left the country in the soup, like in a muddier position than it was. And this insistence that this extremely long and complicated and legally dense report speaks for itself when it clearly does not seems like a disservice. And then to come and not really want to talk and to seem kind of grudging and hesitant and to offer even less clarity, I just don't get it.
I mean, a couple of points there. One is that one of the things that will, of course, go down as a real turning point in this is that Barr was able to. Barr did simplify and clarify.
He didn't have any compunction about that.
And he described the report that he read, which is not the report that was written, but he did a really good job of sort of creating a simple characterization that people were able to, you know, that defined the narrative. And so that was very important, which Mueller never did because Mueller was behaving in this rectitudinous way. I also think, like, you did see Mueller slightly come to life when he was talking about the Russian interference. Like, that was a point in which
he did perk up a little.
He was concerned. And it is, the tragedy of this is going to be that because this became a partisan, essentially a partisan issue, and it became an issue around this president, and the president made it a kind of make or break for him, we have lost the fact that we had this incredibly successful, comprehensive disruption of our political system. And
by the Russians.
By the Russians, that had shaken the confidence, that it sowed division, it peppered us with divisive propaganda, possibly even threw the election to the candidate favored by the Russian government, the candidate who incidentally had financial interests in it. And there's been effectively no response, no concern, no crisis, no stand in defense, no protection of the electoral system, of the electoral process, of how we do it. And it's an open invitation to any country in the world that wants to interfere. They can do it. It's an open invitation. They can align themselves with particular candidates. And it has significantly discredited the American electoral system in a way that is hideously damaging in the long term. And Republicans don't want that any more than Democrats do, really. I mean, like,
yes,
they're true patriots.
But they can't figure out how to do anything about it, because it seems like it's playing into this narrative that's anti-Trump.
Right.
Well, it has entrenched patterns in it has quickened partisan patterns in politics right now in this really ugly way, which is to say that you had the feeling yesterday in the hearing that Republicans were essentially saying, WikiLeaks, nah, no big deal. When, in fact, during the campaign, the consensus estimate of all the intelligence agencies was that the Russians had stolen information, given it to WikiLeaks, and WikiLeaks was disseminating it. And then the candidate, Trump, said, go look at WikiLeaks.
John, you're a longtime student of Washington, of scandal, of politics. Why? So I think if you had stepped back and said, here are the set of facts that we've learned about Russian interference in the election, about the president's financial ties to Russia, about the ways in which the presidential campaign tacitly accepted or sought, didn't reject help from Russia, about the way that Russian interference acted, about the way the president attempted to quash investigation, fire people, suppress information, induce people to lie, all discovered by a Republican prosecutor, an independent Republican prosecutor. I think you would say, wow, this is incredibly devastating. What a shocking scandal. And this has surely shaken the foundations of the Republic. This president has been impeached by now. He's resigned in disgrace. And yet we essentially have a political, when you look at sort of polls, at least, no change at all from where we were at any other point in this history. This scandal has not changed a mind, shaken anybody that we can tell. Was that avoidable? Like, was there some other way this could have rolled out? Why, if you're a Democrat, has this been had so little impact?
Should we blame Fox News?
Well, we can blame
conservative
all. You can blame Fox. You can blame the mainstream media too, which covers things in the present moment rather than the things in their larger context.
Yes.
I think you can blame partisan rallying, which means that if you believe two things, that what the Russians did and the encouragement of the Russians doing what they did was awful, but you also think that people all the way from agents investigating this in the FBI who sent texts to each other about how unctuous Donald Trump was, you can believe that they were basically trying to undo a democratically elected process through their investigation. And that while you may think that what the Russians did and all these other things are bad, admitting those things out loud gives energy to the people who are trying, in your view, to undo a democratically elected president. And therefore, you're just not going to do it. What keeps your feet to the fire is Fox News and there was a great quote, I think it was in The Atlantic, about a woman who was interviewed and said, I was surprised to hear that there was anything negative in the Mueller report, because I'd been watching Fox News and it seemed all
news to her.
Yeah. So that certainly is part of it. And the reason that matters is that that woman, multiplied by many thousands, is a voter who will support a primary opponent of an elected official in Washington. And then I think there's obviously overreach by people who thought Robert Mueller was going to deliver them from Donald Trump and turned him from the
nonpartisan prosecutor.
Thank you, nonpartisan prosecutor, into basically a tool of the liberal wing of the Democratic Party.
And maybe that was part of why he resisted speaking with more clarity. But everything about the political and media environment you just described suggests that his tactics were a failure, and that by refusing to counter Bill Barr's like utter partisan clarity, he left us like with these really troubling facts and no clear way to act on them.
All right, last question on this. Does this, Emily, effectively mark the end of this investigation? Is this, for all intents and purposes, over?
Yeah. I mean, the impeachment questions are going to continue.
You and think?
I mean, yeah, because I think some voters and some Democratic politicians are going to continue to raise them. And I guess they can keep trying to get some information and kind of like fight these side fights. But I think the country is going to be done with it. And I think that's like we should be done with it in the sense that it's time to just start thinking about whether you want Trump to be reelected or not. I mean, that's always been the most effective tool of fighting back if you think he shouldn't be president.
If our elections are determined by the most partisan people who participate in primaries, there's a huge incentive for presidential candidates to keep talking about impeachment.
Right. It's one of the people they did yesterday.
Right. And it's one of the reasons people think that having the primaries so influenced by the wings of both parties tends to warp our politics. And this goes back to the beginning of the 20th century. So it's not necessarily a new thing. But that's one reason it'll stay in the conversation. The second thing is that the people, when they're evaluating impeachment, say, you know, the reason impeachment was created, as Ben Franklin said at the Constitutional Convention, was to get presidents off the hook as much as get rid of bad ones, that it would be a kind of good, smart process to evaluate the evidence, sort it through, and then say, you know what, there may be a cloud around this guy. That cloud should be dissipated because he did nothing wrong. Well, that is pretty to think so. But what we, I think, learned from this hearing is that we don't have a process for evaluating in a neutral way and using reason and critical thinking a set of facts. And so absent that, it seems odd to think that an impeachment process would not devolve into a total gooey, sticky bag full of wasted time.
Gooey. A gooey bag of wasted time. That is a weird mixed metaphor. It sounds like something out of a Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. Slate Plus members, you get bonus segments on the Gabfest, other Slate podcasts, for just $35 for your first membership in Slate Plus. Today on Slate Plus, what should you spend the rest of your summer reading, watching, listening to? We've got your summer culture for you. Go to slate.com/GabFestPlus to become a member today. Jane Mayer, who's I think listeners to this show know how much I admire her relentless, fantastic reporting on politics, has produced the must-read political story of the moment in The New Yorker. It's a very long account of the fall of Al Franken, the Minnesota senator, and it asks whether he should have left the Senate following multiple allegations of sexual harassment, but primarily one allegation from a woman who was on a USO tour with him some years earlier. The piece has mesmerized people, primarily on the left, and has really divided them. So, Emily, what did Mayer find in her reporting, and was Franken exonerated, in your view, by it?
I don't think Franken was exonerated.
Was he exculpated?
You know, I'm so excited that now maybe that word could, like, I try never to use that word in my writing because I don't think most people know what it means. Exonerated's much better, or like, you know, something that goes to innocence, right. I think. But anyway, maybe exculpated will actually enter the common lexicon. No,
I don't think
John's
it will.
Like, forget it.
I don't think it will.
Yeah,
but I remember when I first learned about the obligation to turn over exculpatory material. I can't remember what trial I was covering, but
you were like,
they kept talking about
what the hell is that?
It's an obligation to turn over exculpatory material. And I was so jazzed that I finally knew what that meant. I thought I'd never have to know that word again. And here we are.
What, yeah. Are you going to do the rest of the show with a toothpick in your mouth?
Yes.
John has a toothpick. He's like some kind of hayseed farmer.
I've become
addicted.
In a tie.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's...
You're a toothpick guy. Maybe that's like a book writing
It is. David Blight. David Blight, when I interviewed him...
The Civil War historian.
Yes, the Civil War historian. When I asked him about his writing process, he said he writes with toothpicks. It's the only time he... and Annette Gordon-Reed was also on this great panel.
Yeah, that was a fascinating panel that I listened to, and they said a lot more interesting things than that. Well, so I'm glad you fastened on to the toothpick.
Well, no, but the toothpick is the thing that David raised at the moment. I can give everybody the full hour and 20-minute discussion.
I enjoyed his riff on how Americans can't handle tragedy, and, like, we never talk about it. We try not to ever imagine ourselves as embroiled in a tragedy, and that's, like, our kind of original... sin's not the right word,
so
but
nice
flaw.
I can't believe you went back and listened to that.
I loved that panel. I was there for the whole thing.
Okay, all right. Can we...
It was great. Anyway, he said he... when I was writing the book, we had these toothpicks. I was like, huh, let me try this. Now I'm like, I can't go on without them.
Anyway,
okay.
Emily.
So, little interlude.
Exoneration. That's back. Meanwhile,
Al Franken, if only he'd had a toothpick. Yeah, I don't think she exonerated him. I think the big contribution of her reporting, which I am also a huge Jane Mayer admirer, was her exposing of how the original allegation against Franken from Leanna Tweeden was politically motivated. That this was she had this experience on this USO tour with Franken. There was this very damning photo of Franken, like, lecherously getting his hand somewhere near her breasts while she was sleeping. I just want to say I continue to find that photo disgusting, no matter how many men I love in my life tell me that, like, whatever, it's just, like, a little prank. She was sleeping. It grosses me out.
But the context that Jane adds, which is this is not exculpatory, but ding, 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 we should have a little bell that goes off every time you use the word exculpatory.
Yeah, everyone's going to be really excited about that.
Yeah, yeah. It sounds like a procedure, though. Okay. That somebody's going to be like...
Come on.
Yes.
We've already done this.
Yes. I mean, we won't need anesthesia, but it will be a little exculpatory. The point was that there was a longstanding skit that had gone on at the USO in which a doctor pretends to examine someone, so that the picture seemed to be a pantomime of the skit that they had done together on stage and that Franken had done in previous. So it just puts context in it, which is what the whole piece is about, which is how do you add context for the purposes of adequately evaluating a set of facts to then make your conclusion, not necessarily being exculpatory, but just, hey, here are facts, and shouldn't you make a decision once you have all the facts? Which, in the case of that picture, I thought was interesting, because, as you say, the reaction to the image itself is quite extraordinary. But then when you learn that this was actually the context, it's
And he didn't write the skit just for her. And this image and this story had been basically, like, being shopped around in conservative circles for years. They didn't bring it out when he was running for Senate. Probably it would have been better for him if they had brought it out then, because probably in 2007, no one would have cared, right? But Tashaun had his disappointment at the time. They held on to it. And then when they brought it out, right at, like, a crucible moment for the Me Too movement, it did have all the impact that that the people behind this were hoping for. And so I thought all of that was important. And the context made me mostly think that, you know, all along with Franken, the question was whether his past as a comedian was going to come back to haunt him. And he tried so hard to have that not be the case, but in the end, it did. And I think that context is meaningful for understanding that photo, much as I still don't want to look at it. The problem.
What do you mean when you say you think that context is important? There's a kind of that when you're in entertainment, he's like, there's a lot of play. He's playing a role. We are on the show.
Yes. Yeah. Well, we don't play roles. Well, I'm not playing a role.
No. But
anyway,
but you're doing something which isn't like your normal behavior.
When you're a comedian, for God's sakes, your job is to push boundaries, and often sex comes into that. And they're all so some of the scolding of Franken that I've been hearing from feminists in the last week, as they basically reject exoneration and push back against Jane Mayer, it gets kind of scoldy, like, in their judging of various things he said about, you know, like, leching after cheerleaders on the USO tour. I think there has to be safe space for people to be frank about sexuality in ways that are not, like, 100% towing the feminist line. And that is part of what was going on here. So I thought all of that was really important and valuable. The problem for me is that there are seven other women.
Right.
And I thought Mayer's handling of those stories, especially when you start to read other people saying, hey, wait, about what about this, was incomplete.
Yeah.
And I still think there's a legitimate conversation, and I want to hear what you guys think about whether Franken should have gotten his Senate ethics investigation as his due process and whether his punishment was proportional. But I just still feel uncomfortable with the way in which the New Yorker story, like the two accusations that bug me the most among those seven women are that he was like putting his hands on people's asses taking photos. And like Mayer sort of got the least attention. And it sounds like from this reporter at HuffPo, Zachary Roth, who'd reported one of those stories, that one of those women decided not to talk to Mayer. And so then it's like her story has disappeared from this narrative. And that didn't seem so good to me.
Other important context to remember here is that the Roy Moore case is going on.
Campaign.
And a campaign is going on. Right. And so Democrats have an interest in getting rid of Franken so they can keep the focus on Moore and win in Alabama.
Right. And there's a Democratic governor in Minnesota and the person who was appointed to replace Franken, perfectly adequate senator who won re-election easily.
It's
a woman, Tina Smith. Impossible to remember.
So Matt Iglesias wrote an interesting piece basically saying that Franken was right to resign. That was the best thing for the Democratic Party. It was in line with Franken's own image as a dutiful public servant. And that it is a mistake for Franken to now try to kind of gin up doubts and opposition about all of that. I thought that was really interesting. I think the political case is correct when you're thinking about this from the point of view of the Democrats. I think that's right. I also think it's a little much to expect Franken not to, like, ever speak again about this when he does feel like he was wronged. And maybe you don't agree with him, but I don't think he has some obligation to stay silent.
I have so many thoughts about this. First of all, I want to go back to the grabbing the ass of women. It's like, I'm a 49-year-old man. I've stood behind women in photographs for my entire life. I've managed never to grab one. It's not that hard not to grab someone.
Have you noticed a thing with photos that's happened in the last year? Because I've totally noticed this. Nobody
will grabs your ass anymore?
No, that has never happened to me. And if it did, I would be really distressed. But anyway, no, nobody wants to touch anyone. Like now the photographers are begging you all to get
I always am like, oh, God.
And I don't like the touching either, but I feel like
I'd like the touching.
Well, right, you do. Right, we disagree about this. But like, I think that there's a way in which now people are doing this hover thing with their arms, right? Anyway.
Well, and there's also, particularly for men who are asked to be in a photo with a single woman.
Their faces freeze. They're like, shit, maybe someone could photograph me from the back to be really clear that like, there is
it's like seven angles, like a top angle. We're going to get a drone picture.
I want to be clear. I did not touch her. Not in any way. It's not like it's okay or like shruggy to go around doing that.
On the other hand, I also think like the lines about him, you know, his carnal lines about the cheerleaders. Like, whatever. The cheerleaders are there? That's the point of cheerleaders is to be lusted after.
And we all lust after. Yeah. Like, that's a part of life. It's okay to be a little bit honest about that.
All right. But there was a point I wanted to make about, I think politicians, there's this weird way in which politicians, unlike entertainers, it's very hard to redeem them because it's kind of a binary state. You're in office or you're not in office.
Right. And what about the idea of like a censure, a letter of admonition? That's not the right word.
Admonition.
Admonition. Yeah. Oh, that's a word. Okay, good.
So for Franken, I think your point that he should be allowed to speak up and make his case, it's a really fair one. Because if you're Aziz Ansari or Louis C.K., you do get this way in which you can
creep back.
And you can creep back into – you can't creep back maybe to where you were – Ansari, maybe, I hope, is going to, but you can't creep back to where you were, but you can come back, and there are stages. If you're a politician, it's like, you know, you're kind of either or. And Franken could run for Senate again, I suppose. He could do that. But it's hard. You either are exiled.
He lost his political career, as far as
100%. 100%. And for something which is, you know, maybe he should have lost 70% of it. But there is no 70% in politics.
Right.
There's only 100%.
Yes.
One of the many things that was interesting about Jane's piece was the level of detail and work she had to do to really capture the fine gradations of all of these different instances. And we were talking earlier about whether there is a venue to properly handle the Mueller material, and you can't imagine that there is in politics in America today. And in Jane's piece, I had that feeling over and over again, which is how would these details be looked at by a sort of fair-minded group of people in order to render a decision? It just seems impossible. But I think what in telling this story, what she was doing was in the next generation, I thought it was interesting somebody saying that essentially his case, and maybe this is what Matt was saying, is a necessary corrective for a series and long history of abuses by men of women. And
it's not fair it all got unloaded onto him, but that's what happened.
That's what happens.
Yeah.
And
that can all be true. It can also be true that if there was a Republican governor of Minnesota, the Democrats would have figured out a way to
correct.
Yeah.
Right. And we should talk about Gillibrand and the backlash or not backlash and all that in a minute, because there are now some Democratic senators who called for Frank Zeptan, who now say he shouldn't
have. I have no patience with those people. Yeah. I have no patience for them. I think it's like virtue signaling, weak, hypocritical. They like went with the mob when it was the time to be in the mob, and now they're like, oh, I want credit for judiciousness. I've learned.
Sucks
I'm
for
wisdom,
Gillibrand, right? Who really is like taking it on the nose for having kind of led the charge.
But good for her. Like, you know, she believed
it.
It's like it's
they're
fine. Like
the, kind of peeling away from
the peeling
her.
Away from her, I think, is it's so unattractive and feeble, and like just live with your principles and say like we did this, and don't. And I hate that.
So
I
the
hate
question
that
then
hypocrisy
is,
and weakness.
So the question then is there a second generation or third generation of this story, not the Franken story in particular, but how do institutions handle a case where a person behaves in a way that is unpleasant? Bad, but shouldn't get them the maximum sanction.
In most fields, we have ways to do that. You admonish people, you dock their pay, you make them take a leave, they come back. There are all these gradated punishments. Yeah, well, maybe the Democrats or the Senate could have designed something like that for Franken. And the part of the story that I'm the most torn about is the lack of the investigation by the Senate and the Ethics Committee. So I absolutely wanted them to investigate in the moment. That seemed like the most important thing. They're supposed to be a mess and dysfunctional, but that was an opportunity to have a publicly conducted investigation of Me Too-like allegations that we could have seen how it went. And all this reporting Jay Mayer did should have come out then as part of it. So that I'm clear about. What I can't decide is whether to blame Franken, who resigned before the investigation, or the kind of the Democratic mob of senators who forced his hand.
Would similar facts about a senator lead to a different outcome than with Franken?
I care the most about the process and the lack thereof, because the scariest version of this are utterly false allegations that run wild and that in our, incredibly quick to judgment without a lot of investigative reporting news cycle just take off and they start taking people down in this way that's very unfair, that both leads to a backlash against the really necessary reckoning. And also, we lose good people who don't deserve it. And that's the part that scares me about how this all went down.
I'm interested in the sort of relative response of the parties to this. So do you guys think that for the Democrats, is this all just some long, drawn out atoning response to having allowed Bill Clinton?
Yes.
And it is.
Yes.
Why? And by the way, is that response ongoing?
Well, interestingly, it is not affecting Joe Biden's candidacy very much, even though the handsy accusations against him. Now, it doesn't quite rise to the level. And I should say, if there was a continuum here from Harvey Weinstein and Charlie Rose to Al Franken, he's still on a much less.
He's like
culpable,
half a Franken.
Yeah, whatever. And Biden,
Clinton is
Clinton
is like 2/3 of a Weinstein.
Yeah, exactly.
Or maybe he's like 3/4 of a Weinstein.
Right, but I do think it's all about you can't avoid the political calculus that gets made in these different situations. Like Franken was expendable; it was Roy Moore moment. Biden, less expendable, and it's sort of like the boil's been lanced.
Why are the Republicans, why has personal morality completely vanished as a thing for Republicans? It is weird that it is so completely gone.
Well, and we're in our third topic, we're going to talk about fiscal responsibility being completely gone. I'm wrestling with it because for me, the first fact that comes back is having covered Republicans and conservatives for so long, the number of speeches and people I've interviewed who've talked about this issue and personal morality and its role in public life and it being a disqualifier, particularly on marriage, you know. But I think it is a version of what was said earlier, that if Minnesota had a Republican governor, people wouldn't have been so concerned. That if Bill Clinton hadn't been an incumbent Democratic president, and remember, there was a lot of blind eye turning when Clinton was the Democratic nominee in 1992 by Democratic women. I think it's a version of the same symptom, which is basically power.
Well, but also, don't you think, like, when you hear some of the evangelical leaders talk about President Trump, they say God put him in this role to help us. Yeah. He's the vehicle. And so it doesn't matter. And also they have some notion of redemption, which he's not actually provided any evidence of. But that's the line.
I don't know. I guess. I mean, I would find that more fulfilling if the feelings and the pollings among evangelicals about refugees was a little more in line with the way I read the Gospels. So that if you really were taking the Gospels seriously and the instructions about how you're supposed to treat the least among us, and you lived the word, you would be on the border helping those people, and you would be prostrate on the ground when you hear about 16-year-old boys dying on a toilet from the flu. You would be incapable of finishing your days because that was happening. So it seems to me there are a cluster of issues for those who have talked about things in one way, and then now policy and behaviors are being allowed that they used to be against. So if it were just about the morality piece, I could maybe add a little more weight to that idea that he is, God acts and has instruments that are imperfect. But I think there's a deeper thing going on here.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hey everyone, it's MSNBC's Chris Hayes. For the first time since 1892, we have an election in which both candidates have presidential records. It's a chance to take a hard look at what Joe Biden and Donald Trump have actually done as president. On a special Why Is This Happening podcast series called With Pod 2024 The Stakes, I'm talking to experts about the two candidates' records on specific policy areas like immigration, taxes, climate, and more. So you know what's at stake come November. Search for Why Is This Happening and follow.
Congress and the administration are on the brink of agreeing to a massive budget deal that would expand domestic and military spending, expand the budget deficit by a lot, and raise the debt ceiling through July of 2021. This deal will essentially take off the table the possibility of a government shutdown or a government default this summer or really during the Trump presidency, and also take budget fights off the table until the next administration. So I think the one theory of the case is, well, you know, it's good. We have a deal. It was bipartisanship. It was worked out between Congress and Treasury Secretary Mnuchin. And, you know, everyone got something of what they agreed to, what they wanted. And there's no risk of a catastrophic default. And that's all good. Another theory is, man, this is just borrowing for the future, raising the national debt, like having no sense of fiscal responsibility. Also, if you're a Democrat, it's just put the problem on to the next administration and possibly a Democratic president who's going to have to deal with Republicans hammering him or her when they're president. Emily, is it a good deal?
I feel like everything you said is true at the same time. I don't understand. Well, I wasn't there negotiating, obviously, but one wonders whether it would have been possible to push this to 2022, say, because it's a big gift for the Trump administration and Republicans not to have this fight again during Trump's presidency. And so one does wonder whether the Democrats could have gotten more in terms of the timing and this notion that, like, McConnell won't use it as a sword against the
next. In 2021.
Like, forget that's just, the idea
who
that anyone.
Said that? What idiot said
that?
Who said that?
I don't remember.
I saw that attributed in some story. And,
like,
I was like, what? Who? What?
I know. It's just like Lucy in the football man.
Did Mitch McConnell's wife say that?
Yeah, precisely. So that bugged me. This question about fiscal responsibility, I have. Does it matter? I mean, it's so on the one hand, it seems crazy to imagine that the United States continuing to pile up all this debt does not make us vulnerable. Like, I just believe that in my bones. I know it's not the same thing as balancing one's personal checkbook, but, like, it can't be completely divorced from reality. And yet there is increasingly this tendency, including among some economists, to shrug off debt and to imagine that we are in some special status as the world's superpower and the world's currency and the world's whatever else, that, like, we can amass all this debt infinitum without distressing our own economy in the future. I don't really believe it, but it's tempting, and it's definitely adding to the sense that, like, nothing that important is at stake here.
Reaction. Let's see if I can just limit them to three. One is everybody's congratulating themselves about having pulled this off and bipartisanship and all that, but it's not that hard in Washington to get everybody to spend money on their priorities. So that's kind of, and by the way, still to claim as an achievement, simply doing your job, which is keeping the money flowing to the government, is pretty small beer, because what you're supposed to do is, through collective action, tackled the biggest problems facing the country, not the self-inflicted wounds you keep giving yourself. That's the first point. The second point is, when people say that the laws of economics have been repealed, they may be right. It has often been the thing they say right before everything goes to hell. Before the Great Recession 2009, people said, you know, risk has been
forever.
Housing prices always go up. Risk has been squeezed out of the market by these cool derivatives that hedge everything against everything else. So you're not going to have massive shocks to things like General Sherman said, what did he say? Something like, people who think that war can be made easy are, you know, usually disappointed by vast destruction. And there's an economic analog to that, which is that the certainty about the elimination of risk is usually a warning sign. So, because the big problems are still there, which is the interest on the debt, the inflation, healthcare inflation, and the aging population, and the promises that have been made to that aging population. So that is a problem. Then the third thing is, having gone and spent, again, so many years of my life at speeches and at conferences and in committee hearings about fiscal responsibility, it feels as quaint and small reading about this budget deal. Those things in the past feel as quaint and out of touch as the Be Kind Rewind stickers you used to put on VHS cassettes. Like, it was just, but they used to, there was so much time was spent on fiscal responsibility, and now basically everybody's congratulating themselves for just totally blowing it off.
And if only we'd reached this conclusion and given a bigger stimulus after the Great Recession, like, maybe that would have really helped the country recover much faster.
Well, right, exactly. And then also the other fascinating thing here is that, and this is not really, this is only, I guess, slightly associated, which is, and I'm sorry, this is number four, is that the tax cut, which is wildly unpopular and which people think, even by the Republican National Committee's own polling, think all the benefits went to the wealthy.
Because they did.
Nobody seems to be penalizing the president's best scores are on his handling of the economy, which again
is... Well, because the economy is humming along. And so, like, that's, he, you know...
One of the things I found most interesting, that one of those studies that we were reading, is this notion that if you look at the difference in economic growth and the economic growth that has happened in the Trump presidency and also has happened in previous Republican presidencies, there's a huge amount of it that is just extra government spending that happens during those presidencies, because Republicans, when they're Democratic presidents, act like, oh, fiscal responsibility is really important, and they restrain government spending. And then when they're Republican presidents, they don't act that way. And it's, there's this automatic sort of Republican president stimulus that happens. And you get half a point added to GDP growth every time. And you get rid of all this sort of fiscal responsibility, and you get hike deficits, but they don't talk about it. And so there's this kind of cheat code that Republicans have for goosing the economy, which is they'll just spend when they have the White House and they won't spend when they don't. And that's a bummer. John, I thought those are four perfect points. I wonder if so obviously McConnell has used the debt ceiling against Democrats in the past. He will use it against them if there's a Democratic president in 2021. Should Democrats, who don't believe in using it probably as a weapon, but should they have used it as a weapon anyway, because it's going to be used against them? Or was there something they could have done where they could have held out for a permanent end to the debt ceiling? They could have said, okay, we'll do whatever deal you want, but it has to come with a permanent end to this.
Right, or at least a few more years, right? Even if you weren't going to do the permanent end, because I do think there's an argument for that, but maybe that would have been a heavier lift. The not getting, it does seem like 2022 or 23 would have been a better year to pick than 2021. I mean, again, it's easy for us to say, but it is like a big gain. Can I bring up something else that I realize this? So the big demand Republicans have is that we continue to beef up military spending. And that seems to remain a part of the Republican ethos, even though there are now much more doubts of military intervention among Republicans than there used to be. I don't really get that. Like, when does Trump's disinterest in, you know.
But he likes having the military. He doesn't want to use it. He doesn't want to.
Right, but it's a little weird. We're like building a lot of toys.
It's super wasteful and pointless.
I think there are three things on the military side. And this is the military
spending.
You're
going to have three but not four on this one.
The military side, you know, spending is interesting because it increases the size of the coalition who might support this for the president. And it is the sugar that makes the medicine go down to the extent that anybody's upset about fiscal responsibility on the Republican side.
There's like one or two senators who seem to still be griping about that. Someone named Lankford from Oklahoma seemed unhappy.
But you obviously, with military spending, you have the fact that it's spread around the country, and so everybody wants military spending in their district. Second thing is that there's been, because of the sequestration, which, by the way, is a part of this story as well, which is that in 2011, the great achievement was getting these sequester caps put on the budget that were supposed to be so painful that it would force a reckoning from the Democratic president about fiscal responsibility. So that obviously turned out not to have worked at all. And what people who care about the military say is, but the caps on military spending so hampered the military that it led to things like planes not being able to be repaired and all kinds of other things that actually hurt readiness. And so there are people who are not Donald Trump fans who believe that, A, this money will allow the military to kind of operate where it should be, which isn't to say that there's not waste in the military, but that given the way things are at the moment, the money is necessary and needed. And also, there is a view about deterrence through strength with countries like China, and also now that money needs to be spent on figuring out how to both propel cyber attacks and how maybe to launch a few. You need lots of money to hire people. Maybe you don't need that much money, but that there are threats. Look, they're always going to find new threats to spend money. I don't mean to suggest that this isn't a part of that same old thing. But in talking to defense hawks who are no fans of Donald Trump's, and they seem to think this is necessary money.
Maybe the military could go build some bridges and some like railroad infrastructure. If we just called it military spending, maybe we could suddenly have infrastructure week actually mean something.
Walls on the southern border.
One other fast thing is that the best time to deal with fiscal responsibility is when the economy is in its biggest humming period, which is now. So that's even more amazing that there's no interest in fiscal responsibility at the time, because obviously when the economy is weakened, that's when
you want stimulus.
Yeah.
Hey, Jon Favreau here. There's no shortage of political takes in 2024, but quantity doesn't cut it. We need a better conversation about the latest biggest election of our lives. On Pod Save America, me and my co-host cut through the noise to help you figure out what matters and how you can help. Every Tuesday, Wednesday, and Friday, Pod Save America is breaking down the political news that makes us laugh, cry, and snap our laptops in half. Expensive year for laptops. Make sure to check out new episodes of Pod Save America on your favorite podcast platform or our YouTube channel now.
If you want to understand what is happening in the United States right now, you really need to understand what's happening with the courts, the law, and the Supreme Court. The battle between democracy and whatever this cage match is that we're witnessing, it's going to be won and lost at the ballot box, but it's also going to be won and lost in the courtrooms. I'm Dahlia Lithwick. I host Slate's legal podcast Amicus, and we are doubling our output, bringing you weekly episodes from here on in, because how else can we keep an eye on the many trials of Donald Trump, the conservative legal movement's assaults on our rights, the Supreme Court's latest slate of environmental gutting, gun safety eviscerating cases on the docket? So follow Amicus wherever you get your podcasts, new episodes dropping every Saturday morning.
All right, let's go to cocktail chatter. Weirdly, it did not turn out to be nearly as sweaty in here as I thought.
It's because I'm here. Yeah. I'm cooling.
You're cooling a cucumber. But I think it's because we all had our kind of very cool cucumber gin fizzes as we were doing the show.
We did. I remember that.
So, Emily, what is the gin fizz that you will be talking about at your fizzy cocktail party?
I have been following with fascination the news about Amendment 4. This was a ballot initiative passed in Florida to restore the vote to, I believe, 1.4 million people was the original claim, people who had were former felons. And then, of course, a couple months ago, Florida's Republican governor signed legislation that essentially imposed a poll tax on these folks. They were going to have to pay back all their fines and fees before they were allowed to register to vote. And Florida has just astronomical sums of money that it charges people in the forms of these fines and fees. And so it just seemed like it was undermining the wonderful democratic process of Amendment 4. So hark. In Miami-Dade County, the elected state attorney, the public defender, and the court system has decided that they are going to let people vote. They've essentially decided to read this bill as only requiring you to pay the fines and fees that are on your sentencing document, which apparently is much more limited and much more likely to have been paid off already than all the other associated who knows what. And so as long as this prosecutor is not going to prosecute, and the court systems believe this is a proper reading of the statute, it seems like these folks in Miami-Dade County should be able to vote after all. So props to State Attorney Catherine Fernandez-Rundle, who is part of this deal, a key part. And hey, if this works, then it seems like it could be a model for other cities with progressive prosecutors in Florida. There are a bunch of those folks. And it's just a really good example of local government pushing back against state officials. You know, we'll have to see whether it holds up in the courts, what happens next, how to notify all these people that they really are eligible to vote. That's going to be a big task for the advocates on the ground. But it's a piece of good news.
It's a piece of good news, but only because there's this absolute abomination, which is that the state legislature took a voter initiative that people had one idea that it was very clear intent, and they completely gutted it and screwed it up.
Right. Although there is this other political cast to this. So in Miami-Dade County and some of the other cities in Florida that might be likely to go this route and try to make it easier, those are where the voters are who tend to vote for Democrats, right? Those are like places with more of those people. And so if it turns out that what Florida ends up with is a strictly enforced gutting of Amendment 4 in its rural areas and a healthy, vibrant vote registration drive, which turns out to be allowed in its cities, that is going to make this amendment have a more blue effect on the state than it would have otherwise. I'm like several steps down.
The state legislature is now going to change the law. They're going to go back and be like, this doesn't work. The only thing that counts is this.
That's totally possible. We'll see.
Bet.
We'll see.
John, what is your chatter?
My chatter is short and sweet, which is an irregularity for me. I listened to the Jane Mayer piece on Autumn, which is a great app that basically reads articles from The New Yorker, New York Magazine, The Atlantic, Esquire, lots and lots of other things in the most pleasing narrative voices. It's like Audible, but for articles. And so particularly for those of us who are challenged by reading anything on digital devices. My New Yorker actual magazine was in New York. It's just a, like, there's no way I could have gotten through her piece as pleasantly as I, if I'd been reading it on a digital device, because I would have kept getting interrupted and all that. Anyway, so it's this nice, soothing, lovely narrated voice of the piece. The only downside is when you want to highlight something, you're screwed. But
certainly they'll develop a hack for that. They'll be like, Siri, please highlight that
anyway,
last sentence.
I downloaded it ages ago and hadn't used it. And a friend of the show reminded me of it. And I've been pleasantly enjoying it. So I encourage everyone to go get Autumn. And it's oddly spelled, or at least I think so anyway. The app should be searched for A-U-D-M.
Okay. My chatter is a follow-up to a chatter. A few weeks ago, I asked you, dear listeners, for recommendations of for ways that I could spend my time physically and usefully, and you've sent so many wonderful recommendations. Maybe actually I'll lose you one day, just kind of run through so many of the excellent ideas you had for me. But one of them ways was a listener, CatFest listener in Pennsylvania, has a farm, an organic farm in rural Pennsylvania, and invited me to come work on his farm. And I went last weekend. I'm going back next weekend and hopefully again the summer, just one day of work. And I recognize there's something ludicrous in this. And in fact, some people on Twitter called me out for this, but I respect the game. But I just want to say, like, I put in a day's work at this farm. It was the hardest day's work I've ever done, by far. Nothing I've ever done is remotely close. It was incredibly hot. It was this over the hot weekend. It was exhausting. It was sweaty. It was dirty. I smell of onions still from all the onions. I sniff. My hands, like even a week later, really smell of onions. It was unbelievably satisfying. It was a chance to meet interesting people from totally different backgrounds than me. The people I was working with were Jamaican men on temporary agricultural seasonal visas. And they work so hard and they do it day after day for wages that wouldn't be a starting salary at the most junior job in any office in Washington, D.C. And so it's a cliche, and it like reeks of sanctimony and sentimental sanctimony at that to praise the virtue of people doing manual labor. But it's unbelievable, like the amount of work that these people are doing in these fields to bring us the food that we eat is stunning. And it's like, you know, it is easily forgotten, easily not seen. And I just, you know, want to thank and praise that work. So I will do it, even though it's sort of ridiculous to do it, because I was so incredibly impressed and admiring of the work that these men were doing. We also, of course, are getting your great listener chatters. You are sending us your things that you're chattering about, the works of culture, the things that you read on the internet, articles that you're talking about at your cocktail parties, and you're tweeting them to us at Slate Gabfest. And there's so many good ones this week. But in honor of the Apollo 11 mission, which has now landed 50 years, we had our 50th anniversary of its return this week. Yoni Shenker sent a tweet thread from Mary Robinette Cowell about peeing in space and pooping in space. And it is so funny. It's just about all.
That was totally hilarious. I loved it.
It was amazing.
The level of detail.
Yeah. What stimulated this from Mary Robinette Cowell was the idea that when the space program started, one of the reasons why they didn't let women in was like they were like, oh, it's going to be problem. You know, how are they going to pee in space? It's going to be a total mess. And she points out that actually the problem that they hadn't solved the problem for men. And she just goes through time, just episode after episode after episode of men and the problems they have peeing and shitting in space. And it's so incredibly funny and vivid. And it was a problem they really had not solved. And it's great. So I strongly recommend that Twitter thread. That is our show for today. The Gabfest is produced by Jocelyn Frank. Our researcher is Bridget Dunlap. Melissa Kaplan engineered the show today. Gabriel Roth is the editorial director of Slate Podcast. June Thomas is the managing producer of Slate Podcasts. You should check us out on Twitter @SlateGabFest, Facebook.com/GabFest. I think we have a Slate.com/GabFest. I think stuff happens there. And you should come to our live show in St. Paul, Minnesota on September 18th. And you can get tickets for that at slate.com/live. For Emily Bazelon, John Dickerson, who I am so happy to be in a room with, I am David Plotz. Thanks for listening. We will talk to you next week where we won't be in a room together. Sadly. Sad, sad. Hello, Slate Plus. How are you? So, summer, a chance to catch up on great culture that you missed during the year, perhaps. If you have some vacation, chance to, you know, read something lighter because it just feels like you should read something lighter. Chance to trash yourself up on television, as people like me do. And so we're going to talk about some of our favorite summer culture and what we're reading, what we're watching, and maybe we have useful recommendations. So anyone want to start?
I'm really into the show Years and Years, which is jointly produced by the BBC One and HBO, and most of it, though not all of it, has aired in the United States. It's this kind of raucous family drama that takes place in the near future and weaves in international...
GabFest fans, that was just a teaser. To hear the rest of our Slate Plus conversation, go to slate.com/GabFestPlus to become a Slate Plus member today.